Hi, everyone, and welcome to AHA. We are super excited to have a really special guest today, part of our Autism Hope Library. Sergeant Goodchild, who is the president of Active Healing, is here today, and we're going to be talking about leveraging movement to improve the structure of the brain. Hi, Sergeant. Nice to see you again. I haven't talked to you forever.
I know. It's awesome to reconnect. Thank you so much for having me on today. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm excited to share with all your listeners some stuff that they probably haven't come across, even in their deep dives about how to help recover their kids.
I love it. And so before we get started, because, you know, I love how you became involved in this work. So can we talk a little bit about how did you become involved in the work that you do to help our families?
So I'm going to give you the really abridged story today, because we could spend a lot of time just talking about that one subject. But I was born with a mild to moderate brain injury. I had the cord wrapped around my neck. It wasn't an ideal birth. There were a lot of issues around it. By the age of five, I'm the oldest of three. So I have a sister who's 3 years younger than I am and a brother who's 4 years younger than I am. When I was four, going on 5 years old, my sister then, you know, going on 2 years old, my parents, for the first time in their life, had a means of comparison, and they were getting, you know, by the time my sister was one, they were becoming concerned about me because my sister was starting to achieve milestones, which I had not, and was acting very differently. You know, she was curious and she would get into trouble, whereas I would be very content sitting in a corner of the room by myself, not really playing with any toys, just being very quiet. And every once in a while, I would jerk. And when my parents questioned my pediatrician about it, my pediatrician at the time just simply told my parents that I had an immature startle reflex and that I would eventually mature out of it. As things progressed, my parents ultimately took me. We lived in a suburb of Boston, Massachusetts. My parents ultimately took me to Children's Hospital. Children's Hospital didn't identify anything specifically wrong with me other than it looked like I was going to be significantly learning delayed. And so they suggested I be put in an early education setting. And in order to get into that program, I had to be brought up to speed with my vaccinations. Mm-hmm. When that occurred, I developed severe epilepsy. So after that round of vaccinations, I stopped producing saliva.
Wow.
I didn't produce any saliva for 9 months. And what had been misdiagnosed as an immature startle reflex became recognized by Children's Hospital in many of the doctor's cases as the worst case of epilepsy that they had ever seen.
Wow.
Subsequently, I was put on a tremendous amount of medications. I was so significantly impacted by those medications that my gums were so inflamed that my teeth couldn't make their way through them. I used to have to occasionally go into the dentist's office and he would take out a surgical blade and just cut my gums back, but he couldn't give me any medication to do that because I was on such toxic levels of anticonvulsants and other medications that had he put me on something for pain, he could have put me in a medically induced coma. My eyes were nearly swollen shut. I was drooling on my paperwork. I had very poor language, very poor mobilities. I was getting beaten up every single day at school by the boys. I was being ruthlessly teased by the girls. And I had a miserable childhood. And that went on from the time I was five until I was nine. And the only solution from the medical community was to consistently up the level of medications that I was taking. So my mother had been volunteering for a family that had implemented a program for their child who had drowned at the bottom of their pool and been able to be resuscitated. But she was, according to Children's Hospital here in Boston, she was supposed to remain a vegetable for the rest of her life. Well, these parents were unwilling to accept that. They had a large number of volunteers that were coming into their house because it was the 70s. And my mother was one of those volunteers. And ultimately, That led to me seeing that same group of professionals. Ultimately, I met with a guy whose name was Art Sandler. Art Sandler was a physical therapist who had formerly worked within this other organization. He was the very first parent. He was, excuse me, the very first person who ever looked my parents in the eye and said, your son is brain injured, and every symptom that he exhibits. So I was exhibiting, I had mild cerebral palsy. I was considered autistic before that was a thing, you know, when that was still one in less than 10,000. So I was considered mentally retarded. I was considered uneducable. I was severely epileptic. My father was told I had Huntington's chorea at one appointment. My mother was told that I should be institutionalized, that she should focus on raising her other two healthy kids and visit me when the opportunity arose. Unfortunately, obviously, my parents didn't heed their advice. They didn't put me in an institution. They ultimately decided to shift gears, and they continued to give me the anticonvulsants, which were not controlling my seizures. Maybe I was having less seizures, but I was still having a ton of seizures, both grand mal and petite mal seizures. So in any case, they started traveling down this other road where Art Sandler, this physical therapist, taught them. Not only he did an assessment, he figured out which developmental milestones I was missing within my profile. He correlated those to different areas of my brain, because we know that specific structures in the brain control specific functions that we're able to perform. He was able to, therefore, through a functional assessment, derive a picture of where my brain was organized and where it was significantly disorganized. And then he taught my parents how to leverage developmental movements to mature those weak parts of my brain. In 9 months, maybe 10 months after beginning that program, where I was learning how to crawl, I was learning how to creep, I was doing a process called hypercapnia, I was hanging upside down from my ankles, etc. Within 10 months of having begun that program, I was completely seizure free, and I was off of every single medication that I'd been taking for the previous 5 years at that point.
Wow.
So from the time I was 5 until I was just about 10 years old, I was on medications. But when my parents began to see that this program was working and I was coming back to life, it correlated with me having less seizures. Mm-hmm. So they took it upon themselves. And I do not recommend that any parents listening to this do what my parents did, but my parents had followed the medical advice for 5 years, or, you know, 4+ years. And what they were getting was a more significantly impaired, more significantly brain injured child. And so when they found a program that they thought was working and they could see a reduction in my symptoms, my mother very slowly began weaning me off the meds. There's a funny story, actually. What my mother used to do was like bite a little tiny piece off the Dilantin or the phenobarbital or the Meberol or the Klonopin or whatever it was. She would bite a tiny little piece off, and then she'd give me the big piece, and she'd fit the tiny little piece into the wastebasket. And as time went on, the pieces that she was biting off were getting bigger and bigger, until one day my father walked into the bathroom and my mother was biting off the tiny, tiny little piece of medication and giving me the tiny little piece and throwing the big pill in the wastebasket. And my father said, "Martha, what are you doing?" And my mother said, "I'm giving him his medications." And my dad said, "Yeah, I don't think you need to if that's all you're giving him." So that was probably my last day on medications. It took me a lot longer than 10 months to recover fully. The whole process took me 4 years, but it got me to where I am today, where, you know, I was enrolled in a private school for grade school. Then I went off to a boarding school. I was very successful in the boarding school. I ultimately graduated there. I went to college at Syracuse University. I graduated actually with a degree in political philosophy. I'm a very analytical person. My first jobs, therefore, were, of course, in finance and advertising. And ultimately, my mother had had lots of families coming around and asking her for advice, because I was in the same school system throughout my entire recovery. And parents just started showing up at our doorstep and asking my mother for help. That ended up turning into a business that I wanted nothing to do with, because I wanted to distance myself from that history as far as I possibly could. And I had no interest in acknowledging it as a child. But as I grew older and time just naturally distanced me from that part of my history, I was working for an advertising company in Boston. I'd be walking down Newbury Street, very glitzy street in Boston. And I would come across, you know, ultimately every few weeks, you'd see someone coming down in a, you know, in a wheelchair, a little boy or a little girl with cerebral palsy. And it would grab at my heart. And I would think, God, I wish these parents knew what they could do to help this child outside of what the medical community is offering them. So ultimately the day came where my boss was fired from his job at my advertising company, and it didn't go smoothly. My boss was a really level-headed, really super smart former Navy SEAL. But when he got fired, he didn't take it well. So that led basically to the firing of the whole department. So I was fired in that process a month or two later. I needed a job. My mother needed help. I ended up coming to work for her. I thought it was just going to be for the winter while I looked for something else. Ultimately, that was 25 going on 26 years ago.
Well, how lucky for our families, though, because not only, you know, are you somebody who's so passionate, but you've lived it and you understand it more than most people can. And how amazing, and I know all the families watching will think the same thing, your mom and your dad. I mean, I think it always starts with parents too, of, you know, if you're watching this, it always starts with the mom and the dads and whoever's the guardian of that child of any age that says, hey, I'm not going to give up. And if your parents would have given up, who knows what your outcome would have been. It doesn't sound like the picture was very nice. So I'm so happy that, you know, you're sitting here talking with me. And it's funny because I think we met, oh my gosh, let's see. I would say was about 13 years ago, maybe. I think my son was 5 or 6.
God, that's amazing that it was that long ago. That's incredible.
So
it very well could be. I mean, it's hard to believe that I started this when I was 25 and I'm now 50. I've officially been doing this for half my life.
That's insane. So yeah, I remember flying out to Massachusetts with my son to come see you, and we did it. You know, it was just me and him on an airplane and a whole bunch of faith. Yep.
Well, I remember that very fondly myself, and I would love to have the opportunity, if it's appropriate at some point in the future, to work with him again.
Absolutely.
But I think that everything that you're doing right now for him is exactly what you should be doing for him.
Well,
and it's what I always tell my families who are starting is, you know, I need to make sure that your child is in a place where he can do this, where, you know, we don't try to build additions onto homes that are actively burning down.
Exactly.
And we have to put out the fire of inflammation. We've got to pull out toxins. There's a whole bunch of things that need to be done before we can really begin to build the structure of the nervous system back again.
Well, that brings me to the question, you know, how can you explain how leverage, you know, developmental milestones to mature the nervous system? Like, what does that mean? Like, when we're trying to understand that, and because I have a lot of families that have kids that are over a certain age, when we're talking about this, let us know, does it matter if you're this age or does it matter at any age that we can help kind of help this nervous system?
So I'm going to answer that question because I think that question is really important to get out of the way so that people are open to hearing what else I have to say. I had a child in here. I had a child in here just last week who was 3 months old. I'm really looking forward and having the opportunity. I didn't give them much of a program. He's 3 months old. You know, that I want to see how he responds. His brain is rapidly maturing, or should be typically rapidly maturing right now. We give these kids very small programs. We see how they respond. And then if the parents recognize that there have been some good gains, they're going to be much more willing to take on an even larger program. So one of the youngest kids I've ever worked with, 3 months old, I've worked with a lot of kids who are 6 to 9 months old, but I think 3 months old is pretty young, but very capable of making progress with a child at that age. And I also just finished working with a woman who is in her 60s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and she was a classically trained New York ballet artist. So you would think that she had the whole movement thing pretty down, pegged down pretty tight. But when we put her on her floor, she did not know how to crawl on her stomach. She couldn't do it. And she had a pretty significant history of trauma, you know, basically mostly emotional trauma with a tinge of some physical trauma in there as well. And she hadn't recovered from it yet. And I did program with her for a year and she recovered.
Wow.
She lost a lot of that trauma and it changed the dynamic of a lot of her relationships within her family. Gave her a resilience that she didn't know she had within her. So the windows of opportunity never fully close, in my opinion. What we're doing when we leverage developmental movements is we're prying those windows right back open again. So I'll speak to that for a minute. We all recognize in one way or another that functions always lead to structure. We also understand inherently that structure always leads to function, right? So if you're out taking a walk with the dog and she pulls you off a curb and you sprain your ankle, well, we change the structure within your ankle. We change functionally how you're able to move on that ankle, right? Now, suddenly 5 minutes ago, you didn't have a limp. Now, suddenly you do have a limp because there's been a structural change. So it's very easy for people to understand how structure has an impact on our ability to function. Likewise, we all know that if we sit around, eat potato chips, drink Budweiser, and spectate all our sports on television, that leads to a very specific structure that all of the women can think of immediately in this chat, right? And it's a lot different from the structure of someone who meditates, is a vegetarian, and practices mindfulness, right? That yoga guru-y kind of a person has a very different body than the person who likes to spectate sports and drink Budweiser. So we understand that the way that we function impacts our structure. What most people don't do is they don't recognize that this doesn't only apply on an anatomical front, that it also happens on a neurological front. And so the developmental movements that a child goes through, especially in the first year of life, but particularly in the first 6 to 7 years of life, those functions are what are laying down both the anatomy of the body and the anatomy of the nervous system, right? So if a child doesn't have a pons, well, if they don't have a pons, they're in a lot of trouble. But if they've got like agenesis of the corpus callosum, where it's completely non-existent, I cannot, through this process, create a structure where one doesn't already exist. So there are limitations to structure, and I recognize that. But if there's a pons there, if there's a corpus callosum, if all the structures of the midbrain are there, what we can do is we can leverage the corresponding developmental movements to build those parts of the brain. So in a very simple way, crawling on the stomach in an army crawl, and I like to focus on mobility, but we can look at this from a lot of different angles as well. But when a child is learning how to crawl on their stomachs, what they're doing is they're developing the pons. The pons sits behind the eyes, just right about here. It's a very small structure, plays an incredibly important role. It's where all your sensory integration disorder lives within the pons. Your ability to bond and feel like you belong lives in the pons. And So serotonin is signaled from the pons. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter that makes you feel happy. If you don't have a functioning pons, or for that matter, serotonin's made in the stomach, so you have to have a healthy gut biome too. But if you don't have a healthy pons, your brain's not going to recognize when you need serotonin, how much of you need, and where it needs to be delivered to, right? So the pons plays an incredibly important role. The next mobility is creeping on hands and knees. Creeping on hands and knees correlates directly to all of the midbrain structures. So likewise, if a child doesn't learn how to creep correctly, they're going to suffer a structural consequence potentially at the midbrain level. And then when a child learns to stand up and walk and run and skip and jump and do all those things, they are building a more sophisticated and developed cortex. So when a child comes into active healing, what I'm doing is I'm creating a diagnostic trail of evidence that is showing me where the brain is strong and where the brain continues to need more work. I'm not just looking at movement though, right? Because again, if the child is structurally out of balance, if they have subluxations in their neck, if they have a tipped pelvis, or they've got something wrong with a leg, that can appear as a movement disability. Right? That can appear as they only use one leg when they crawl in their stomach, or they don't have an extended reach. So rather than it being rooted in a brain dysfunction, it could be rooted in a structural issue, right? So what we want to do is we want to back up our evidence from several different perspectives. So I don't just look at mobility. I look at how the eye functions. So there are functions of the eye that are controlled from the medulla, the pons, the midbrain, and the cortex, and they're all different. So same thing goes for the tactile column, right? So I'm looking at a very early level. I'm looking to see if tactile reflexes are in place. I'm looking to see how is the child's pain tolerance. Does he have a high pain tolerance for certain things and a low pain tolerance for others? Is it all one or the other? And then we get into, you know, how well can they use their touch to discriminate objects in a bag where they can't see them? And can they balance on one foot? Can they do that now with their eyes closed? We can do it from a manual perspective, you know. Do they have a tight grasp? Do they have the ability to let go? Do they have a pincer grasp? Do they have cortical opposition? Do they have sophisticated bimanual skills? Are they able to write their name? How do they hold a pencil? So there's all sorts of different ways that we can look in at the brain and see how it's functioning at all these various levels, because we know, again, specific structures of the brain control specific functions. So we can use those functions as a window to how well organized the brain is. Once we understand that, we then know which movements and activities we need to do to grow the child's brain from the lowest point where there's evidence of damage, and then begin to build the brain upward from there. Does that make, am I making sense? Am I rambling?
No. So basically, you know, when you're talking about, obviously you have the, you know, the nervous system, but then you also said you have to look at the structural side of the equation. So how do the two go hand in hand? You know, how do we help both sides, I guess?
So what I do at Active Healing is I focus on the functional side. But when you focus on the functional side, you can't help but have a positive impact on the structure, right? So we have kids who come in and we need them to crawl because they don't have an appropriate awareness of pain, temperature, and discomfort, right? And so just as an example, some of these kids, they really, really, really like deep pressure, like that big, strong hug. They really like it. But if you go and put their hand gently on their arm, they're going to run away from you, right? They might not bond. They might have aggression. They might have anxiety. They might have all sorts of different things because of what's happening within the pons. So for that child, what we're going to do is we're going to put them on, we're going to do certain exercises that teach them how to crawl, because you can't tell them how to crawl. If you tell them how to crawl, you're only appealing to the cortex. We don't want to appeal to the cortex. the midbrain and the pons, they don't have the capacity for language, and they never will. Spoken or written languages are way outside. So when we tell a child what we need to do, they're taking that information in cortically and responding on a cortical level. Generally, the cortexes are not the damaged place where a lot of focus needs to be put, despite the fact that that's exactly what the school systems do. Typically, what we need to do is we need to focus on the pons and the midbrain. So we take this child who we're trying to have a neurological effect on. We're trying to change behaviors. We're trying to improve bonding. We're trying to have, we have all these goals that we're trying to achieve. We're not trying to achieve better structure in the bottom of the foot. But guess what happens? A lot of times we go from a kid who's flat-footed to a kid who begins to develop an arch because he's learned how to dig with his toe. And when you learn how to dig with your toe, you naturally arch your feet. We have a lot of kids who are toe walkers who then develop a heel-toe gait because in this process of learning how to crawl, you've stretched their heel cord. And now their heels can hit the floor. They're no longer restricted by a tight heel cord. You have kids whose hips weren't properly functioning. And suddenly, you know, going like this from the perspective of your legs, going like this, you know, doing that 600 to 1,000 feet a day of that reciprocating motion of your legs, guess what? It develops a healthier hip structure too. It also develops secondary curves in the spine. So you can see this big, you can see oftentimes a big structural improvement. You see better ranges of motion. You see all this stuff develop because these activities are global. This was part of the body's natural blueprint so that it could develop healthfully. But that said, I like to bring people onto the team who are going to specifically address the structure. Right? The same reason that if you fell off that curb while walking your dog and sprained your ankle, I wouldn't take you the next day and start training you for the Boston Marathon. It wouldn't be fair, right? If I have a child who's got really significant subluxations in their spine and I'm trying to facilitate all of these skills within them, I've got to get rid of those subluxations if that child's going to be successful and do it in an efficient way. So I often refer to chiropractors, I refer to cranial sacral therapists, I refer to osteopaths, I refer to all sorts of different people to try to address the structure so that we're not limited by some physical barrier.
So as you're talking, you know, I'm trying to put it all together. Obviously, I know about your story and I know about your work, but it's been a while. So I'm, you know, my brain's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Or, oh yeah, I forgot about that. So my question though, as you were talking, because I don't remember this, and I'm sure families watching might have a similar question. So you were talking earlier, if a child, you know, you have to figure out a certain way to crawl. Can they crawl on their stomach? Can they crawl in an army crawl? Can they stand on one foot? Can they close their eyes when they're standing on one foot? Can they skip? Can they run? Can they hop? Now, my question is, what if you have a child, and is this possible? Let's say you have a child that can skip and can hop and or maybe, you know, based on telling
and
them.
And can bolt,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
A kid that can elope.
Yeah, and then but then maybe they're not crawling this the right way. Can you go back and kind of, I'm thinking of like a ladder, right? Like maybe they missed that rung of the ladder. Can you go back and kind of retrain that brain to get that rung back?
This is much more often the case than not, is exactly what you're discussing. So what happens is when we watch that child who runs, if you watch them with a professional eye, you'll see that maybe they're on the balls of their feet, right? Or maybe they run with these really kind of restricted shoulder movement where they're not pumping with those arms. Maybe the hands are out here and they're acting all crazy. Or maybe he's got what I call the Terminator run, which is that like, like your arms are blades kind of run. They can do the skill. But what you'll see in that skill is all the artifacts of the earlier skills that haven't been accomplished. Does that
Yeah, so basically
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so then you can go back, and then what happens is, as you were talking, how the structure just automatically starts to get better. So if you go back and you reteach, quote unquote, those rungs, right, for lack of a better description, then what's going to happen is their run, looking at least from a professional eye, if somebody could tell, then they're maybe not running on the balls of their feet anymore. Maybe they're not doing the Terminator run. You know, their running is the way that their brain should be on a healthy level. And so by doing that, also that means all the other stuff in your brain's kind of getting, I think of it almost like a puzzle, right? Like, so like things are kind of like out of whack. I forgot what that game is. Like where you spin, like you turn the knob and then it vibrates and then everything pops up and then you have to kind of put it back.
Oh my God, perfection.
Yes.
Oh God, I haven't thought of that in for years. I love that game. You have 1 minute to put all the little.
Yes. Yeah. And I kind of think of that with the brain, right? Like, so you're like doing this and it's like, it's all the pieces are there, but you just kind of have to put them all back is what kind of how I visualize it.
You just aged both of us a lot.
Everyone's like, well, I don't know that because it seems like they brought a lot of the 80s stuff back at like the store. So they might think it's brand new.
We'll go with that. So what this is one of my favorite times of year to actually, from a certain perspective, to take a child on, right? So we've had this kid, he's been in swim lessons all year, right? He's made no progress. He's still like this, you know, he's still doing some sort of like modified doggy paddle. He's not getting those arms up above him. He's not kicking, you know, he's not turning his head. Swimming is not going well, right? But it's the end of the year. Everyone, camps are ending. Swim classes, at least in New England, are over. And we're thinking about going back to school. This is also the time of year where a lot of parents are like, oh my God, this was going to be the summer where I focused on my kid. I was going to make a ton of progress. Where did the summer go? School's starting. All those concerns are right back forefront in my brain again. I got to get them in to see someone. And they end up at my office, right? We take them through the program. And we go through the next 9 or 10 months, and boom, summer comes around again. The kid hasn't had any more practice in a pool. He hasn't seen a pool since he was doggy paddling. He jumps in the pool, and he's doing a beautiful swim.
Wow.
Right? Because we've taught him how to crawl. We've gotten rid of the reflexes. We've gotten rid of all the things that were preventing him from swimming in the first place. And it happens all the time. It happens every year. At least a couple of times, I get a call from a parent who's like, oh, you know, spring comes around, swimming pools open up again. I start getting calls from parents and they're like, oh my God, we put him in the pool. He can swim. Last year he couldn't swim and now he can swim. And that's what it's all about. You know, obviously when I was nine, I did the program from the time I was nine until I was 13. I'd recovered from my seizures by the time I turned 10. I could run, not well, but I could run. And I'll tell you, there's just like for everyone, there are certain moments in your life where you have such a sense of pride and such a sense of accomplishment that you'll never forget them, right? Those days that will just always be with you. For me, I have a lot of those days, but as far as the early days are concerned, the fastest kid in our school, in grade school, his name was Arthur, and he outran everyone. Like in the sixth grade, he was outrunning the ninth graders. In the seventh grade, outrunning the ninth graders. In the ninth grade, fastest ninth grader, until I came along. I'd been doing program, and the end of my program involved me going out for runs. And we used to have to do presidential physical fitness things in school back in my day. And one of the things was like timed runs. And it came down to me and Arthur, and I outran him.
Wow. I love it.
So I have some other pretty proud days where the kid that had been bullying me suddenly was not bullied. I was not being bullied by, but I was actually bullying.
Oh, wow.
Those were some good days. I mean, you can absolutely go back. That's why I talk about these windows never close. We're just prying them right back open.
20, 30, 18, in puberty, all this crazy stuff. And I know I want to
be a 60-year, you can be a 60-year-old woman who never learned how to crawl, and I can teach you how to crawl, integrate reflexes, and take you through a process that heals you of trauma that you got when you were an 8-year-old.
And to me, I think that's, you know, we all think, you know, as you get older, well, I know you and I don't think this, but a lot of people that are brand kind of new to this, you sometimes are being taught, and I think they're probably still teaching this in school, that your brain, you know, pretty much stops doing certain things by a certain age. I still see commercials, which, oh, there's just one commercial that I see often that just, I cringe every time I see it. Oh, your child's learning stops at 5. You have to read to them. It's like, I think they're trying to do something good. Like they're trying to get people to like want to read, but they're not true because your brain doesn't stop at 5. Right. And so like they're pushing this though at 5, it's going to stop for whatever reason.
You have to have the right set of tools.
Yeah.
Right. But what people aren't being told by their pediatrician, I wish that everyone who went into their pediatrician's office and asked a question, when the pediatrician answers no, you know, hey, you know, pediatrician John Smith, my son has autism. You know, he's 10 years old. It was mild. We just got diagnosed. Is there anything that we can do for him at 10? What do you hear?
Yeah.
No, there's nothing that can be done. You need to accept that he has autism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If instead of just hearing the words no, what you actually heard was no, not that I'm aware of, that would be game changing.
Exactly.
Right? If we recognized that their experience was pretty narrow and that they have no idea what's being done in the alternative fields for these kids at a lot of different ages, you know, then parents wouldn't resign themselves to the fact that they have to accept their child's medical condition as a lifelong diagnosis.
Well, and I mean, to me, and when every time I talk to you or I read about what you're doing, it's just such hope. And I know we have a little bit of time left, and I want to make sure, because I know you have a lot of cool stuff at your clinic. And guys, you work with people all over the world, so they don't have to just be living in Massachusetts. You can do telehealth or telesummit or whatever that's called, correct?
So I do, I have clients in Nashville, Tennessee that I fly out to see. I've been working for a very long time in Austin, Texas, but I've kind of I had planned to shut down Austin, Texas a while ago because my office here in Massachusetts is getting so busy that it's hard for me to travel to as many places. So I had Austin, Texas, Nashville, Tennessee, occasionally out in Wyoming. And then I have my busy office here in just north of Boston in Beverly, Massachusetts. I have clients that come and see me from Vancouver. I have clients that come and see me from all over the place. So people travel in from all different areas. I like to see my clients in for an in-person visit once every 4 months, but everything else can be done by video conference. But I need an opportunity to actually lay hands on a child and get to some of the finer points of an assessment that just I'm not capable of doing over Skype. Someone else might be, but I find it very difficult to assess certain aspects of a child through a video camera.
So basically when this COVID thing is, you know, hopefully where we can travel and not be, you know, quarantined for so long, then guys, it's like three times a year is when you need to see them. And then everything else is done by telehealth. Is that what it's called? Telehealth, I want to say.
Yeah. Right? I guess that's what we're calling it now.
Yeah. I don't know what to call it. Whatever. You can see through Zoom.
I called it video conference until telehealth came around.
And now I want to talk about, you know, before our time is up, I know you got some cool things in there and some cool technologies that you brought on board to really make a difference, you know, at Active Healing there. Can you share some of the things that you brought on and that you're really excited about?
I will say that everything that I have brought into this office has been vetted through the autism community. I now have a much broader population of people that I work with. So for the first 20 years that I did this, I didn't solely focus on kids, but primarily I saw children. And I saw children with developmental challenges. 5 years ago, I moved into a new office. And that allowed me to showcase all this equipment that I have pulled into this office for the benefit of families with kids with autism and start offering it to a much broader population of people. So I now support people who have complex health challenges like cancer, early onset Alzheimer's, all sorts of different tick-borne illnesses people come in here for. So I have now an even broader audience. So we'll start with the first piece that that came in, which was probably in, like, I'm going to say 1999. I started using a technology called audiovisual entrainment. Audiovisual entrainment is a way of, basically, it's a hack for meditation. And what's cool about it is that using it, we can put you in any in any state of consciousness that we want. So for kids with autism, we can lower their anxiety levels by cycling their brainwaves at a slower rate, trying to bring them out of beta and put them in a more relaxed, like alpha beta state of consciousness. The equipment's really cool. You wear a pair of headphones and a pair of glasses. The lights flash at a very specific rate. If I were to spend a lot of time on this, I mean, my videos on this are an hour long, so I'm going through this really quickly.
Well, I think we can do another talk too about all the different cool therapies, like a part two.
Yeah. So audiovisual entrainment is a really, really cool technology. I've been using it for over 20 years. It's an amazing technology and it can be very useful. And quite often when a parent buys it, they buy it for their child. They end up using it themselves. And I frequently get a phone call sometime later in which they say, I bought this for my kid, but this is the best investment I've ever made in myself. Because, you know, I've got parents who have a form of PTSD from raising these challenging kids. And they need an opportunity to dissociate from their reality in a really positive way and go into a deep state of relaxation. And they don't have time to practice meditation for 5 years to get there. Mm-hmm. But we can do that in 4 to 6 sessions with an audiovisual entrainment machine. So they're super cool. After that, I brought in something called a sonic whole body vibration machine. You can actually see them right here. So those are my three sonic whole body vibration machines. You stand on that platform. The only thing that causes that platform to vibrate is a frequency of sound. Different frequencies of sound resonate in different parts of the body. No matter what frequencies we use, we're activating your lymphatic system and putting you into a state of detox. I thought this was going to be an awesome piece of technology for kids with autism. Turns out it is. What I didn't expect was what a phenomenal piece of technology it is for kids with cerebral palsy.
Oh, wow.
It is amazing. It takes so much tone out of their muscles and gets them into a state where I can actually physically work them. So and we can do everything. We can support your immune system. We can work on your mitochondria. We can go after your adrenal function. We can work on certain muscle groups. We can do all sorts of things. It's probably the most versatile piece of equipment I have in this office. And all of the people who come in the next thing I'm gonna show you are my foot baths. Everyone who comes in to do a foot bath, probably 95, 98% of my people do what we call the shake and soak. So the shake and soak is when you get on the TurboSonic and then get in the foot bath. If I'm not doing shake and soaks all day long, it's usually because I'm doing shake and bakes. And the shake and bake is when you get onto the TurboSonic and then you go into my beautiful far infrared sauna. So these are what my foot baths look like. I don't think you'll find very many, if any, other people who do foot baths in pedicure chairs.
I love it.
There, that blue little box that you can see just behind my shoulder. That is the unit that controls it. It's from a company called Ion Cleanse. They're located in Colorado. They are the company that has done the most validating research on their product. It's an amazing product, but people should be aware of the fact that using an Ion Cleanse, the ions that you absorb not only help you detox during the 30 to 40 minutes that you're doing the foot bath itself, but that you are in a state of increased detoxification for the next 3 to 5 days.
Oh, wow.
The heaviest detox sometimes happening on day 3 or day 5 post foot bath. And if you're taking life preserving medications, if you're on anticonvulsants, if you're on blood thinners, if you're on heartbeat regulators, et cetera, you should not use an Ion Cleanse, because theoretically we can lower the amount of therapeutic medication in your system, and we don't want anyone having a negative effect as a result of that. So in each of these foot baths, I don't know if you can see it, but there are these little, my piece of paper. There are these little arrays.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can see that, but that's what does the magic. So the chairs are beautiful, comfortable chairs. They give you a really nice massage if you're lucky enough to do one in my office. And then the other thing that I do in here is called pulsed electromagnetic field. That is phenomenal for grounding, and it's awesome for pain. It's awesome for inflammation. And I use it as a part of many different protocols in this office. I have a protocol that I really like for concussions. It seems to get me really good results, and it starts with a pulsed electromagnetic field session. And then the other thing is a far infrared sauna. That's kind of the last thing that we'll highlight today. Should I walk people down and show them the infrared sauna?
Yeah, let's show them that real quick.
All right.
I love your office. It's so cool.
Thank you. So just a quick shot. This is my neurological reorganization space. So this is where I do the magic with kids who have learning disabilities, brain injuries, behavioral problems, etc., autism spectrum disorders. That swing is an awesome swing for vestibular stimulation. But I actually prefer to hang kids upside down from their ankles from there. And if you look across the room, you can see a blue pair of straps hanging on the wall. I actually tie kids up by their ankles and hang them from that point right there. And they love it, generally.
He does it as fun. So if you guys just came in on that part, it actually helps. It's not a torture.
It's incredibly therapeutic, too.
Absolutely.
So this is a far infrared sauna. And it looks like the last person who was in here had some blues on. So normally the lights don't shift like that. This is a three-person sauna. I'm going to turn down the music.
This is how unprofessional.
But it's probably, so we can see it goes up to 150. I don't know how well you can see that.
Too
blurry to see, but this is a nice big room. So I'll put this over here, and I'm sitting right here. You can see there's enough room for three people in here. It's a beautiful sauna. This is from the company Sunlighten. They've done a bunch of research on kids with autism and shown that using a Sunlighten sauna can have a real positive impact on those kids. Just like Ion Cleanse has done a tremendous amount of research on kids with autism and found amazing results with their ATEC scores. So again, everything in here has been vetted through the autism community. And it has multiple different applications. I never know what I'm walking into. Every day is a little bit different because the office fills up as the day goes on. So, today I've had a woman with cancer. I've had her daughter who has a cold. It's not COVID, she just has a cold. I had a gentleman with prostate cancer. I had a house, just a, you know, a professional woman and mother who makes part of her routine to keep her sanity to be in here three times a week. She starts off Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. She's in here at 8:15 to do a shake and bake.
Wow.
And then I have all my Skypes with all my different families for their kids with various reasons. So each day is really very eclectic in this office.
Well, I love it. It looks so peaceful and it's so put together nicely. Oh my goodness. It's like, looks so organized. I love it.
Well, it's a little messy right now because it's the end of my day and I didn't have time to clean as much as I would have liked to, but.
Oh, I think it looks fantastic. So, you know, I know that all the parents right now are so excited to learn everything they have. You know, how do they find you? Do they go to a website? Do they call?
So we have a website. It's activehealing.org.
Okay.
My email is Sarge with an E, S-A-R-G-E, at activehealing.org. I'm on Facebook. There's two Sarge Goodchilds on Facebook. One is me and should be recognizable as me. The other one's a flaming S, which is for some reason the Facebook profile that my son decided to use.
Oh, how funny. So we know he's related.
He's 18 now.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so weird. I remember when he was so little.
Yeah, it's crazy.
How do they get older, but we don't?
And then I've got, you know, at Sarge Goodchild is my Twitter handle. We have an Instagram page, but I'm not very good with Instagram.
Website, they can find you, they can email you, find you on Facebook. Obviously that's going to be on the screen here as well, so they see that. You know, for all the families out there, you know, that are feeling a little bit like, oh goodness, you know, a little helpless sometimes. Sometimes you're just lost, you don't know which way to turn. They're so excited, I'm sure, listening to everything that you just said. But do you have one thing that you would like to leave parents with?
Yeah, you know, your parents with one thing, your listeners with one thing, I think that one thing would be, we have a tendency to separate everything into categories, right? And compartmentalize things. You know, like we've got a behavioral issue over here and we've got a food sensitive issue over here and we've got a movement disorder over here. The thing that I would want to leave your parents with is you shouldn't compartmentalize like that. It's all part of the big picture, especially when it comes to the movement disorder. The fact that your child has a weird run or never crawled on his stomach or never crept, that's not separate from the challenges that you're facing. That is a major contributing factor to the problems that your child is facing. And ultimately, your child is going to be better off if he addresses not only his nutrition, not only what's going on with his structure, but if you address functionally what's happening for him at some stage.
I love it.
Movement disorder is not a separate disability. It is central to the challenges that your child is facing.
Absolutely. Well, this has just been such a wonderful, wonderful talk. And I always learn so much from you. And I feel like it's just opened my eyes to another way to go, oh, I want to try that again. Or, oh, I want to learn more about that. And I'm sure so many people right now are feeling the same exact way. And what I think that the most important thing that you talked about was that the window doesn't close. If you can help a child at any age, I think that if you're watching right now and you're thinking, gosh, my kid is 18 or my kid is 32 or my kid is 6, it doesn't actually matter the age, because as Sergeant told us, like, we can continue learning, we can go back, and if they miss that rung, we can go back and help that rung. And I love, love, love that. I love the hope that you instill into families, Sergeant. Thank you so much.
And what I do for all of my, so almost all of my families enter this process through screening. So I do an hour long video conference screening, because I see clients from all over the country, and it doesn't make sense to get in a plane or drive across the country to come see me if we haven't established that your child's a good fit for me at this stage in their life. So I do a screening. And at those screenings, I will say, you know what? This is the perfect thing to implement at this point. Sometimes I say, this is not what your child needs right now, and you need to start somewhere else. So I charge $150 for an hour-long screening. You'll get more information from that screening than you'll get from many, many other doctors, multiple appointments with many other doctors. And if he's not a good fit, I'm going to be very straightforward, and I'm going to tell you that your child is not a good fit for this program. But I'm also going to tell you some really interesting areas to go look for help, because I've been doing this for 25 years. I'm fairly well networked and aware of a lot of other therapies that might be useful to you.
And so when they do visit you, before we end, how long are they there? For an entire week, or how long are they there typically?
A good question. So what happens if you do come in for a full assessment and a training? What happens is I see you for, let's say you're flying from somewhere else. You will fly in, and I will generally see you from 1 to 4 or 2 to 5 in the afternoon. You'll then go back to your hotel room. I will be working on a written report of findings. I'll be coming up with all the elements that are going to comprise your child's program. And then you're going to return probably at 9 or 10 the next morning. I'm going to give you that program with the list of elements as well as his written report of findings. And then I'm going to train you, and it's going to take 3 hours to do your training. And then you're going to fly home. And every week for the next month, I'm going to see you once a week, every week for the next month for an hour. And then I'm going to see you for an hour every other week for the second month. And then we're going to go into a regular every other month set of appointments with me. So I'll see you I'll see you 8 times in the first 2 months.
And so when you're flying out there, you're just basically there for 2 days, because you fly in.
One day. Because if you fly, let's say you fly in on a Monday, uh-huh. I see you Monday afternoon, you spend Monday night in your hotel, I see you Tuesday morning, you can fly out Tuesday afternoon.
Got it. Okay. So that's something for people to know. That's not hard to do. That sounds, and you're more hands-on than any other therapist, doctor, specialist, consultant, whatever that I've ever seen. And I love that, because families, sometimes they need that. They need someone to hold their hand and be like, you know, and I don't care what stage you are, like, you know, if you had been doing this for 15, 16 years, you still need some help out there, people. I mean, it gets hard sometimes.
And that's why I set up all those initial 6 appointments in the first 2 months after you've left my office. We have 6 more appointments. I want to make sure that you're not letting any bad habits sneak into the program. And I want to make sure that we're establishing a really good relationship, that I'm getting to know you and your family really well as your child. I want your child to look forward to his appointments. Not every kid looks forward to his appointments with me, but the majority of kids who come in here, even if they come in here first appointment with me, they're hesitant. Usually they don't want to leave. Usually the parents are dragging them out of the appointment. Sometimes I have tough kids, but I can usually even establish a good relationship with those children. So I work very, very hard at that.
Well, I love it. Thank you so much for giving us all this time today, Sergeant. It's been so fantastic catching up with you. And, you know, again, guys, the whole message here is don't give up. There's help. You know, check out Sergeant's website, find him on Facebook, bug him, ask him questions. And when this quarantine is over, I highly recommend, you know, if this is a fit, to visit him. And there is the trusty companion right there.
My mascot, who's now telling me that she's thinking that dinner is kind of past due and she wants to go home.
I love it.
She's literally circling at the side of
my car. I love it. Well, it was a pleasure. And what's your puppy's name again?
Her name is Indy. She's 13 years old.
Indy. Okay. Well, Indy, we're all done now. And thank you so much, Sergeant. And thank you guys for watching. Until next time. Bye, guys.
Thank you very much. Best to you.